So what we'll do today is we'll start with a short, since we're doing this practice today, I thought that our meditation in the beginning will be relatively short. So we'll just do a any kind of concentration meditation you're familiar with. So, for example, breathing meditation. You can do it if you wish. I think everyone here is familiar with breathing meditation. Yes. Okay. If you're familiar with the visualization meditation, then you can do that too. That's another form of concentration meditation. So whatever you feel comfortable with. So we'll start with that. That's a way of settling our minds. And one thing that actually recently I was at a retreat, and the retreat leader, one of the things he suggested is when we do a start a meditation, that we kind of scan our body. They do this in yoga a lot, So you scan the body and you start from the bottom and kind of see where the muscles are tense or there's aches and pains and discomfort and things like that, right? And you scan all the way to the top and you'll find a lot of times like the jaws are tense and, like neck is tense and the eyes, like underneath the eyes. So scanning the body actually is a really good way of not getting distracted during meditation. A lot of times if when we're, in meditation, you're kind of having to always, this is one of the obstacles to meditation. You find that, you have to keep changing your seats or, you're itching, scratching over here or your mind is kind of wandering to various parts of your body and so forth and so on, right? So if you do the scanning and you kind of breathe into, as you find a muscle or area that's tense, you kind of breathe into it with some gentleness, some compassion. You just observe it. You don't have to do anything about it. Just observe it and just breathe into it, into that area. And you just let go and just keep going, right? And so you find that you can meditate longer with less, with more intensity and less distraction. So that's a trick I learned, 6 or 8 months ago at this retreat that I was at. So we'll start with that, scanning meditation, and then we can do, whichever visualization you feel comfortable with, right? So some of you who came late, there were a couple of people, I think. There's a prayer that I handed out. Oh, just you? Okay. No, it's on.
Oh, there you go.
Maybe my... Okay. All right. So this class is about the daily, setting up a daily practice, and we spoke about why a daily practice is essential for progress on the spiritual path. Right? So we covered that in the first session. And we also talked about the seven limb prayer, right? The six preparatory practices, you know, with the, and then the seven limb prayer with the prostration, the confession, you know, offering and beseeching, you know, requesting, all, you know, all those things, right? And so this practice that we'll do today kind of puts all of that stuff together, so you know you have a practice that you can use. And we'll talk about the practice specifically, why it kind of integrates everything, right? But one thing I didn't tell you last time is that each of the seven limbs actually is an antidote to something, okay? And I can never remember them, so I actually looked it up and I wrote it down. So the first limb is prostration, right? Both mental and physical prostration. And that's an antidote to pride. For obvious reasons, right? Because we are, with the act of prostration, we are acknowledging that we don't know everything. We are, you know, that there is something higher than us that we can strive towards. Offering is an antidote to greed or miserliness. You know, greed is something we struggle with all the time. If you think about it, right? Greed is, you know, in our daily life, we struggle with greed. Miserliness, maybe not so much, but maybe we do. So offering is a good way, you know, it's all mental offering anyway, so it's a way to kind of create the imprints. All of these things are creating the imprints in our minds, right? So maybe we don't succeed in this lifetime. We're still going to be miserly in this lifetime. But we create the imprint so that in the next life we can conquer it, right? So confession is, that limb is an antidote to the three poisons, which are attachment, anger, and ignorance, right? They're the main three obstacles to our enlightenment. So attachment, anger, and ignorance, which is the basis of all of them, really. And it also purifies negative karma, so that's confession. Rejoicing, it's an antidote to jealousy or envy. So when we rejoice about others' activities or others' accomplishments, then that's an antidote to, you know, jealousy, because it's clear, obvious, I think. Beseeching, which is, you know, request to teach, stay and teach. So that purifies negative karma related to our gurus, the Buddhas or Bodhisattvas. So, you know, having negative thoughts about the gurus or, you know, about the Buddhas, for example, you know, not having faith in them, so forth and so on. Requesting to turn the wheel of the Dharma, which purifies negative karma, from not treating Dharma materials well, avoiding them, not understanding their value, so forth and so on. So if you, like, for example, I don't know, put a Dharma book on the ground, you know, which is considered a sign of disrespect to the Dharma, or, you know, put your feet towards holy objects, things like that, right? So that's purifies negative karma from avoiding Dharma materials, not treating them properly, or not understanding their value. And then dedication is an antidote to the selfish negative mind. And purifies our delusions and illusions, multiplies our merit. And most importantly, which I'm sure I talked about, well, I don't know if the other classes, if I taught them, I'm sure I talked about this, but I'm sure others, Ravi or Don has, which is that the reason we dedicate everything that we do and every prayer, every activity, Dharma activity, we end with a dedication. Like if you do a food offering prayer, you end with a dedication. You know, if you eat food, whatever you're doing, any activity, you end with a dedication. And the reason is that whatever positive merits we gain by some virtuous activity, we want to seal that merit from being from destruction. And then it can be destroyed. You know, like moment of anger, they say, can destroy countless, I don't know, eons, they say, of positive merit, you know, because anger is such an incredibly powerful negative emotion, right? So anger, you know, jealousy, these kind of things destroy our positive merit, right? So with dedications, if you dedicate based on bodhicitta, you know, so in other words, I dedicate my merits, you know, for the benefit of all sentient beings, that's dedication based on bodhicitta, right? Or if you dedicate based on emptiness, you know, so, you know, there's part of, you know, one of the dedications, for example, is may the eye that is empty, you know, Lama Zopa Rinpoche's favorite one, which is may the eye that is empty achieve enlightenment that is empty, then lead all beings who are empty to that by myself alone. So that kind of dedication using emptiness, those two, if you do dedications using either of those two things, then it seals your merit. And so it's, you know, it can be used, it multiplies and can be the cause for many, you know, great things in this life and future lives, right, for our spiritual progress, if for nothing else. So that's one reason to dedicate. But the other reasons are purifies delusions and antidote to selfish negative mind. So those are the antidotes to the seven limbs in our seven-limb prayer. If you're new today, you're probably a little confused, but just hang in there. Sooner or later, it'll make sense. So the reason we're doing the seven-limb prayer is basically, if you remember, is that we need to accumulate merit. You know, accumulate merit, it always sounds rather greedy, you know, like, I don't know, it sounds rather, I don't know, like, you know, I'm accumulating, you know, yet another, I don't know, gadget, right? Something like that. It almost sounds like that. But His Holiness the Dalai Lama says, when it comes to accumulate merit, you have to be greedy. You want to be as greedy as possible. And the reason is that all our spiritual progress depends, the basis of it is merit. You know, and I know I've said this every class, so but I'm saying it again, because it's really important, because we have to remember this when we're doing these prayers. Why are we doing this, right? Because I'm saying this because I question it myself. I used to question it till I really got it finally, right? Which is that, you know, accumulation of merit is like creating the foundation for building a house, right? You can do all the practices. One can do all the practices, you know, great tantric practices, great, you know, esoteric practices. But if we haven't done the basic work of accumulating merit, it's just like castles in the air. You know, it has very minimal benefit, if any. Because the practices become dry, they become rote, they become almost without purpose. And so So the accumulation of merit is basically gaining the blessings of the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas and the holy beings, which creates the conditions for us to make spiritual progress so that we can, you know, our hearts can be softened, as my teacher says, right? So our hearts become soft so that we are receptive to the Dharma. We are receptive to our gurus. We are receptive to their words. You know, we see things in a different light. And so that's what accumulation of merit is. And so one time I asked Geshe-la, actually. I said, you know, Geshe-la, you know, I'm doing my practice, which I'd been given by my teacher many years ago, and I'm doing this practice, and I don't know, it's kind of feels old, and it's not really working. And he said, are you doing, for different people it's different than for me, he says, are you doing the Lama Tsongkhapa Guru Yoga? And I said, well, maybe once in a while. He goes, well, that's the problem. You need to accumulate merit. You know, if you're not doing the prayer, you're not accumulating merit. If you don't have merit, you're not going to, that's why your practice is like that. And he's right. You know? So I started doing it. And things changed, you know? So there, it makes a big difference, you know, if we make a sincere effort at doing these prayers. Okay. So maybe we'll just do this practice now. And it's a wonderful practice, it's a beautiful practice, actually, especially this practice. It was put together by my teacher many years ago, and he's recycled this in many forms. And this version is from, he was here, I don't know, Venerable Rene Fuchsy, some of you may have seen him, he was here, I don't know, a couple of months ago? So when he was here, he and I went through his, whatever, various different versions of this prayer, and he created this one for the retreat that he did here. And so the nice thing is that this is a chantable practice, which makes, I find, a much bigger difference, you know, because you go much slower, it goes deeper, you're not just reading the words. And then at some point, if you do this often enough, it becomes, you have it memorized, it's easy to memorize. And then you can just do it no matter where you are. And so that's one. The second thing is that the seven limbs, you know, a lot of prayers you'll find are the seven limbs, you know, they're very, you know, they're just kind of dry, you know, I sincerely I bow down with body, speech, and mind, and, you know, so forth and so on. And, you know, it's just, you read seven lines and you're done, or whatever it is, you know, you're done. But this one, actually, he took the verses from the King of Prayers. Those of you who are familiar with the King of Prayers, it's a beautiful, it's a prayer from this really long sutra. It's actually at the end of the sutra, where this boy who travels through these many different realms of the Buddhas finally comes, meets Manjushri. And his eyes are opened to all the, I don't know what the word is, all the wonders of the Buddhas, I guess, you know. And he wrote this prayer, right? So that's where the King of Prayers come from. So my teacher chose these seven limbs from the King of Prayers. So this is a very authentic practice because the King of Prayers was written, I don't know, 2,000 years ago, something like that. So that's the other reason. The third thing you'll find in here, as we go through it, you'll see, is after you do the seven limb practice, there's a place where you do the mantra, you know, on page 6. You'll see Tata Om Mune Mune Mahamunai Soha. That's the Shakyamuni Buddha's mantra, right? So we do the mantra and we visualize the blessings from the Buddha, you know, to us, right? And then there's a place, you know, where it says Calm Abiding Meditation. This was for the Calm Abiding Meditation retreat. So that you can do, like, you know, breathing meditation, visualization meditation, concentrate, whatever it is, if you wish. And then there is a review meditation on the Lam Rim. You know, there's a contemplation on the graduated path by the seventh Dalai Lama. This is a very simple, actually, simple one. And it makes, and so you can read, and we'll talk about how to meditate on the Lam Rim. And so when you meditate on Lam Rim, you do what's called a glance meditation, a review meditation. You go through all the points once to remind yourself all the things that you have been meditating on so that you don't forget them. Or to know what the context is. What are you going to be coming up in the future? You know, so that. And then after that, what one usually does is meditates on the particular topic of the Lam Rim that you're meditating on, right? So if you've got death and impermanence you're spending time on, you do the review meditation, and then you do the death and impermanence, right? And then you finally do the dedication, right? So basically in this one practice, you know, when I have a morning practice, right? My morning practice is a slightly different, it's not this practice, but it's a different practice, but it's still a guru yoga practice like this, you know, which has all the same elements. And that's basically what I've been doing for the last 10 years, 12 years, 15 years, whatever it is. But so I just do the, you know, because it has all, you know, it has accumulation of merit. It has the Lam Rim, meditations in it. It has this place for where to do the contemplation. Everything is built into it. So if you do this, then you don't need to do anything else almost. You know, but of course, if your teacher or Geshe-la says, you know, well, you should do a practice on Tara for, you know, next 6 months, then that's a different issue. Then you put this aside and you do Tara. You know, your teacher, of course, gives you specific instructions, right? But this is a good way to start, you know, to at least, you know, keep a, you know, keep practice going so you can continue to make progress. You can feel kind of, you know, think, and if you do this, I guarantee you that in, I don't know, a few months' time, things will shift. That's how it works, you know? Things will shift. And for the better, that is. Okay. Yes?
What can you put in place of the Kalabhati meditation?
You don't have to do the calm-abiding meditation, although the three, you know, the nice thing about this practice is it takes a seven-limb prayer, it takes concentration, and it takes Lam Rim prayer, all three in together. Because you need, as we talked in the first class maybe, one needs concentration meditation to be able to develop the focused mind to be able to do analytical meditation on the Lam Rim. Right? So one has to have that. Right? It doesn't mean that we just do nothing but concentration meditation and 10 years later we do Lam Rim meditation. That doesn't work either. It has to go together, right? So that's why this practice has the calm-abiding meditation, which is essentially concentration meditation, and the Lam Rim all in one place, right? So I guess my answer to you would be, it would be best to do a concentration meditation. You know, some days if you don't have time, you can skip it. You know, you have to use your own kind of sense of what works for you, right? None of this is left, cast in stone. Sometimes some part of the seven-limb prayer will really, really appeal to me or really, you know, grab me, right? So I'll spend a long time on one of those, you know, maybe it's rejoicing. I don't know. So I'll just sit there and rejoicing and just contemplate on rejoicing. You know, I'll spend 10 minutes, 15 minutes, whatever it is. So then I may not do the calm-abiding meditation because I've kind of used up my time in a way, right? So I may just then do the Lam Rim, you know. So like that, you know, you have the freedom to move things around as it appeals to you. But what I'm saying is this practice kind of takes the entire Dharma and puts it in there, right? That's the beauty of it, of any guru yoga practice. This is just another guru yoga practice. This is based on the Shakyamuni Buddha guru yoga. I mean, there are other guru yoga practices based on other deities and great masters like Lama Tsongkhapa. So. Okay. So should we get started then? So I'll read the visualization. So in the visualization, so remember that we're doing this prayer. Let's pretend that we've done our three prostrations, right? We've done, the six preparatory practices, right? So this is the fourth one, basically, in it, right? So we've done the prostrations. We made our water bowl offerings, right? We have sat down on our cushion. And now the fourth part is visualizing the merit field, right? So the merit field in our case would be, Shakyamuni Buddha in front of us, with all the other Buddhas and Bodhisattvas around him. And if you have your personal teacher, then your teacher would be in front of you. Your teacher as inseparable from the Buddha, right? So the Shakyamuni Buddha appears, but he is inseparable from your teacher, from your guru. So in space in front of you, upon a lotus, sun and a moon seat, imagine Buddha Shakyamuni. He's the manifestation of the omniscient mind of all the Buddhas. His body is very magnificent and is in the nature of golden light, wearing the three robes of a monk. His face is very beautiful and he has a loving smile. His eyes are long, narrow, and fine. His gaze is peaceful. His hair is black, and on the crown of his head is a pinnacle, the Ushnisha. The palm of his right hand rests on his right knee, and his left hand rests on his lap in the mudra of meditation, holding a bowl filled with nectar. He sits in the Vajra posture in the center of an aura of light. Each feature of his holy body represents an aspect of his omniscient mind, and he is looking at me with compassionate eyes. So let's really stabilize that image. Surrounded by countless Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. So you can imagine Manjushri on his left, Maitreya on his right, all the lineage gurus, Atisha, Nagarjuna, Lamasongkhapa, all the great masters of India and Tibet, all around them. So that's our merit field. So then we'll do the refuge. I go for refuge until enlightenment to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. By my training in the six perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all living beings. So the six perfections, for those of you who haven't covered it yet, are the highest activities of bodhisattvas that we all strive towards. So there are ethics, ethical conduct, generosity, patience, joyful effort, compassion, and wisdom. So those are the six perfections. I go for refuge until enlightenment to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. By my training in the six perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all beings. I go for refuge until enlightenment to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. By my training in the six perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all beings. And then we set our motivation for this practice. So, because the purest motivation is for the benefit of all beings, right? So our practice is really to help ourselves so that we can help others. So that's why we always do the four immeasurables as part of a practice. So may all beings abide in equanimity, free of attachment and aversion. May all beings of happiness and the causes of happiness. May all beings be free of suffering and the causes of suffering. May all beings find good rebirths and the bliss of liberation. So now we do the seven limb prayer from the King of Prayers. So this is where the tune starts, and I'll go and then you can follow as you learn it. To you, O lions amongst humans, who come in the past, present, and future, in the worlds of the ten directions, I bow down with body, speech, and mind. By my wish for the Bodhisattva's life, many Buddhas appear to my mind, and I bow down to every one of you with bodies equal to the world's atoms. On every atom are countless Buddhas, each amidst countless Bodhisattvas. I imagine all phenomena like this, completely filled with Buddhas, in celebration to all gone to bliss, with inexhaustible seas of praise, and with sounds of melodious verse, I sing of the Buddha's qualities. Beautiful flowers, precious garlands, sweet music, scented oils and parasols, radiant lights and heavenly incense, I offer to you, victorious ones. Fine clothing and sweet fragrant perfumes, sandalwood powder piled high as Meru, a spectacular array of offerings I offer to you, victorious ones, with deep admiration for all Buddhas and faith in the Bodhisattva's life, with transcendent offerings peerless and vast, I bow down and offer to the victors every harmful action I have done with my three doors of body, speech, and mind. Besieged by greed, anger, and confusion, all my heart I rejoice in virtues of all Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. Solitary realizers, hearers, and in the virtues of all beings. Lama Tsepo Rinpoche here, after rejoicing, he always says to pause and reflect and really try to rejoice in the activities and the accomplishments of all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and all the great masters who have come before us, on whose shoulders we stand, and the fact that the Dharma teachings are alive because of them, that His Holiness the Dalai Lama is still teaching in New York, in our own continent today, that Geshe Gelug is at our center, and that he is such a qualified teacher who is guiding us. And, you know, it's all due to their kindness. They rejoice in their incredible works and their kindness and all their, activities. So we really have to think like that. Because when we rejoice, we're also accumulating merit from their activities, right? We get, what is it, I don't know, half their merit or something like that. But Lama Tsepo Rinpoche says, you know, this is like one of those examples of being greedy. When you have to accumulate merit, be greedy. The one of the few playtimes you can actually be greedy. So this is a good way. So we rejoice, we stop, we think, and then we move on. So requesting to teach.
You lights of the world's intended directions, who have gained a Buddha's omniscience, all you who are my spiritual guides, please turn the supreme wheel of Dharma. With hands in prayer I earnestly request you who may actualize Nirvana, please stay with us for eons countless as the number of atoms of the world. For the happiness and the benefit of those wandering in samsara, whatever slight virtue that I may have created by paying homage, offering and acknowledging my faults, and by rejoicing and praying that Buddhas will always stay and teach us, I dedicate for full awakening.
So that's the seven limb prayer, and then we did the mandala offering. So if you remember, all the Buddhas have their the physical aspect, and then there's the mental aspect. But the mandala offering is essentially, you know, all the Buddhas have a pure land that they reside in, right? So, Lama Tsongkhapa, for example, Buddha Maitreya resides in the Tushita pure land, right? So sometimes you hear teachers say, you know, to make prayer so you can be born in the Tushita pure land so that you can get teachings directly from Buddha Maitreya. And Lama Tsongkhapa supposedly hangs out at Tushita pure land too. Because when you do the Lama Tsongkhapa Guru Yoga, you imagine Tushita pure land and Lama Tsongkhapa here is with his, you know, two disciples. Where did he go? Right there. You know, so you imagine, you know. So he hangs out in Tushita. So anyway, so all the Buddhas have their pure lands, right? So the mandala offering is, the mandala is basically you're creating this pure land for the Buddhas, right? This beautiful place with beautiful streams and, you know, I don't know, babbling brooks and, you know, there's all these beautiful creatures and all their sounds are like Dharma teachings and so forth and so on. So all these descriptions of these pure lands. And so you kind of make this pure land and you offer it to the Buddhas because that's where you want them. You offer it to them, you know, like that. Well, the other aspect of it really is that the mandala offering is we are basically, you know, offering our innermost qualities, you know, to the Buddhas. And so in a way it's kind of like it's this connect, you make this connection, you make this deep connection, you know, it's called taking the essence. You take the essence of the practice is basically in the mandala offering. And this, all the stuff about the ground adorned with perfume and flowers, Mount Meru for world, sun and the moon, this is the back, you know, 2,500 years ago, this is what the cosmology, Indian cosmology of the center of the universe was Mount Meru, this mountain, which happens to be somewhere in the Himalayas between India and Tibet. And then there were these four worlds, you know, the sun, you know, the four continents, and then the continent that they were in or we're in is the southern continent, and then the sun and the moon, you know, et cetera, you know, they're in various parts of that. So that's why you have this description here, right? It comes from a long time ago, basically. But we kind of just still use that same because it has power in the actual prayer itself, you know, because this prayer has been practiced by thousands, millions of masters, right? So it has this power just in the prayer itself. You know, one of the interesting things I found was that they had the, you know, every civilization, you know, they basically, I shouldn't say every, as far as I know, most civilizations, you know, they basically, when they first come up with the cosmology, they basically have themselves at the center of the universe, right? And everything else, you know, everything else goes around them or is somewhere outside, right? But in the Indian cosmology, in the Buddhist cosmology, they basically said, no, there are four continents, and we just happen to be one of them down below, and then there's Mount Meru up here. And each of the other continents are actually like you actually try to go, you know, if you go higher in your plane of progression, you know, spiritual progress, you kind of want to go into the other continents, you know, because those are better, you know. So it's kind of interesting how they didn't have themselves the center of the universe. But in any case, anyway, it's just an aside. There's a hand mudra, but I'm not going to do the hand mudra, you know. You would do it here. I'll show it to you. It's not a big deal. So basically, you can do this is perfectly fine, by the way. So, you know, you don't have to do the hand mudra. But basically, I don't know how to explain it, but you basically put your hands together like this. Okay? And then you keep the middle fingers up. Right? These two fingers. The middle fingers up. And then you keep the third fingers up also. And then you cross over your pinkies and you hold them like that. Okay. Anyway, I can show you later on if you're really interested. And there we go. And the reason is that the two third fingers sticking up is Mount Meru. And each of these fingers touching each other, the four worlds. In Sun and the Moon, I don't remember if the Sun and the Moon is in here. But anyway, so that's why it's like this. But that's a technicality. We don't really have to do it. I'm just letting you know, if you see people doing it, that's what they're doing. So you know what it is. Okay. So this tune is slightly different. This tune goes by the Tibetan tune, you know, the Saji Poki. So if you know that tune, then this is the English for that tune. This ground adorned with perfume and flowers, Mount Meru, four worlds, sun and moon, imagined and offered as a pure land. May all beings enjoy this pure land. I send this jewel mandala to you, my precious guru. So you imagine here that Buddha, the Shakyamuni Buddha, is very pleased with your practice, with your offering, right? So at this moment, you know, you can imagine that there's a smile on his face and that he's really pleased at our practices, our sincerity, at our perseverance, our effort, you know. And so, and here, if you wish, this is where we make prayers for our, you know, for whatever your prayers for your, you know, whatever your pray, you know, your spirit for your spiritual progress, you know, prayers for realizations, you know, may I, you know, make, for example, you know, if you have prayers, for example, that you can do a retreat on certain topic that you, you know, and that you really want to do it, that may that come true. Prayers that, you know, people, for example, make prayers, may I not be separated from my gurus in this lifetime or any of my future lifetimes. You know, that may I achieve some level of bodhicitta in this lifetime. I mean, all those kinds of things, right? Spiritual, you know, prayers, you know. Prayers for wealth and whatever, prosperity and all those things, they're not spiritual prayers, right? So those are mundane prayers, if you will. So those don't fall here. You can still do them, I guess. But that's not what this practice normally has in it. I mean, for example, you know, if you were doing Lama Tsongkhapa Guru Yoga, there's a bunch of prayers in there, you know, that's built into the practice. This practice doesn't have prayers built into it, you know. So there it goes, something like, may my capacity for listening, reflecting, and meditating increase. This is, good Lama Tsongkhapa practice is all about gaining Lama realizations, right? So, may my capacity for listening, reflecting, meditating increase. May my gift of explaining, debating, and writing improve. May I achieve the general and sublime realizations. Please bless me to become just like you. So that's actually a prayer that one can do, right? We want to be just like our gurus and like the Buddha. May the transcendental wisdom of simultaneous great bliss and emptiness arise. May the stains of believing in the true existence of illusory thought be purified. May the fog of mentally created doubts be cleared. Please bless me to become just like you. So they're really, you know, they're really heartfelt prayers. You know, please bless me to become just like you. So that's really heartfelt prayers. So that's the kind of prayers we want to make. You know, that's where the softening of the heart happens and so forth and so on, right? So we make the prayers somehow the prayers come true. You know, slowly. You know, I know I've heard people say, you know, you just leave them out, you know, you just set them up out as prayers and the answers come, you know, like that. I don't know, you might have heard people say that. But it does work like that. It's interesting how it works. I don't know how it works, but I think it does work, because I think it's worked for me. And I think it's worked for others, you know, otherwise they wouldn't recommend continuously to do these things, you know. So prayers for realizations, that's where we would do that. And then we've done the practice, so what we do is we absorb the Buddha in us, right? Because we then in our mind stream, we imagine that we become like them, right? So again, it's creating the imprints, right? So we absorb the Buddhas in us, we have all their realizations, and we, you know, we, so that's the kind of, you know, and through that practice, create the imprints and create the realizations in us, you know. It also kind of makes us feel like we're not that separate. You know, sometimes it feels like we are so, all this is unattainable. It feels it's unattainable. You know, that the Buddhas are so far away, up there, way up there, you know, somewhere in the you know, past the solar system maybe. And, you know, we're down here and, you know, there's such a big gap and there seems to be no hope. And, you know, it's like that, right? And, you know, all these things written in the books, I mean, can't, you know, how can I really gain any of these things? But it's not like that. And so when we absorb the Buddhas, we become one with them. And so we become close with them. You know, we don't feel this gap. You know, so that's what we're trying to cultivate, that we can do this. We can gain some self-confidence, you know. We don't have the self-doubt so much. So that's what this is all about. So then we do the absorption. Glorious and precious Rud Guru Shakyamuni, please abide in the lotus and moon seat at my crown. Take care of me with your great kindness and bestow upon me the attainments of your holy body, speech, and mind. And, I guess we don't do the absorption. Oh, the absorption is later. Okay. So we'll do the mantra now. So as we do the mantra, as it says, so this is very important because we have to really feel it, right? We have to really try to feel it. Even if we can't, we have to pretend. You know, in the beginning, maybe we have to pretend, you know, you fake it till you make it, that kind of thing. So as you recite the mantra, we first visualize that white light flows from the Buddha Shakyamuni's heart. It enters our body, speech, and mind, and purifies us of all disease, spirit harms, negative karma, and obscurations. And secondly, and then we visualize that golden light flows from Buddha Shakyamuni's heart and grants us all the spiritual realization. So the first thing, we imagine white light comes from him, enters us, and purifies us of all the obstacles, right? All our physical diseases, mental diseases, negative karma, ignorance, you know, all the obscurations. So it clears us of all the obstacles. And then we imagine golden light, which is basically the, you know, the form of his realizations come into us, and we gain all his realizations, right? So we'll do the mantra, and we'll do it 21 times, and you can imagine, you know, the white light, maybe for the first however many times, and then you can imagine golden light coming from the second however many times, right? Wait a minute. How does it? There's a different tune that we do here. That's why I got confused. How do we do the tune here on Sunday mornings? Hey, moon. Okay, that's ma. I don't want to confuse you, so we'll do that one. Ta ya ta om mune mune maha munaye soha. Ta ya ta om mune mune maha munaye soha. Ta ya ta. Soha. Daya da. Dayada mune mune maha munaye soha. Dayada mune mune maha munaye soha. Dayada mune mune maha munaye soha. Dayada visualize that Buddha Shakyamuni melts into light, and this light absorbs into you. Our holy bodies, our body, speech, and mind become one with the Buddha Shakyamuni's holy body, speech, and mind. We gain all his realizations. Create imprints to be just like him. And we remain in the state as long as we can. And that's pretty much the actual prayer. You know, I mean, it took us a long time because, you know, I went slowly and talked a bit in the middle. But it doesn't take that long, you know. And and the nice thing is that once you have, you know, absorbed the Buddha, you'll find that your mind is automatic, or at least I find my mind is automatically in a very calm state. You know, you're at peace, regardless of what has been going on. You know, so you're at a near and really nice place to do whatever meditations you want to do. And sometimes, you know, I will do this practice even if I'm, you know, if I'm suffering from some emotional turmoil or anxiety or something, I'll just do the practice, just the prayer part, you know. I'll just do the prayer. And, you know, I've done it long enough that I know it by heart, so I can just do it anywhere, in, you know, wherever I am. You know, if I'm feeling really stressed or something, I'll just do the prayer part of it, you know, and do the absorption. And it really has immense power and benefit. So I really encourage you to try to do it and stick with it. And if you do, you'll find that it really makes a big difference in your life. I found it makes a big difference in my life. Hmm.
Do you always do it verbally, or do you do it mentally?
Well, if I'm in a crowded place, I do it mentally, right? But it's good to do it verbally, at least under your breath. You know, I mean, you don't have to speak it very loudly, but as long as you, because there's, it's interesting, if you can hear yourself, you know, it seems more real in a way, you know, especially if you're chanting it. You know, if you're chanting it, if you do it just in your mind, then you tend to go very fast. After you know it for a while, it goes fast. And going fast is somewhat antithetical to actually the point of the practice, right? So you want a natural way to regulate it is if you verbalize it to some degree, you know, and especially if you're chanting it. it kind of naturally just syllables the way, you know, it kind of regulates it. So that's one benefit. The other benefit is you're doing it both with your body and your mind and your speech, right? All three are engaged, right? So that has another benefit to it, right? You're, you know, so like that.
Question?
Hmm. Sure. I do. I change it around. I do it sometimes in Tibetan. I do it sometimes in English. Sometimes I'll do it like some of these prayers, there's Tibetan versions of these, you know. So I'll do one verse in Tibetan. I'll do one verse in English. I'll all, you know what I mean? Yeah. This is, you know, you can do anything you like. Really.
So you could change the tune.
You could change the tune too. I mean, if it, you know, the tune isn't cast in stone either, you know. I mean, the Tibetan tune is cast in stone. You know, in other words, if you're Saji Poki, like Saji Poki Joksing Meto, that one you shouldn't change, right? Right. But if you're doing an English one, then, you know, if you, I do this tune because that's how I learned it. That's how my teacher taught it to me. So it has I have a certain connection with this tune, right? But for you, you know, if another tune works for you better, that's fine. I mean, whatever makes this practice more helpful for you, I think that's really, at the end of the day, what's the most important thing, you know? I mean, if we can only just do that exactly that is written forever and ever, you know, we have to personalize it, you know? Each of us is different.
Hmm.
Yeah. Right. Right. And that's a good question. That's a good question. I've asked this question as well. And the answer I've gotten is that some chants, some mantras, and the mantras, etc., you know, like if you're doing the Vajrasattva mantra, Om Vajrasattva Samaya Manupalaya Vajrasattva Nupalaya, etc., right? There's actually a cadence to it, you know. Those have, that's actually Sanskrit, it's not even Tibetan, but there's certain things like Saji Poki, the bundle offering, the Vajrasattva prayer, you know, the prayers themselves, you know, the mantras themselves. The syllables actually, what I've been told, is the syllables actually have a special meaning. It's not just the prayer itself or the mantra itself. The syllables, in a way, have been endowed by special... not power, but... I guess special powers of benefit or whatever, you know, because they have been chanted by so many masters. If you think about it, for 2,500 years, people who seem to be so remote to us now, you know, Nagarjuna in the 2nd century, Ananda and Madhgalyana in the 4th century BC, 5th century BC, I mean, these chants are really old, so they have a special power in them. And what I've been told is that especially the Sanskrit ones, they were written in that way so that they actually, when you know Tantra more, you'll know this, but they actually work at a different level. They work at a kind of a subtle, the subtle level, the subtle mind. It's not just verbal, mental thing. They work at a subtle mind level in our winds and channels, right? So those mantras, that's why those mantras that you notice in the prayer books, etc., they are not changed. They are the original mantras, the original prayers. Okay. A lot of the other stuff has been translated into English, right? So like this, for example, Ata Om Mune Mune has not been translated. It's just the same. It's the rest of it, the King of Prayers, for example, has been translated into English with a different tune, right? So that's why some prayers one has to do in Tibetan or English, Tibetan or Sanskrit to get the most benefit out of them. The other ones, you know... One can use English, you know, like the Lama Chopa. Those of you who are familiar with the Lama Chopa Guru Yoga, that's a big, long Guru Yoga, you know, 50 pages, 70 pages, I don't remember. There's a nun, Venerable Drime, who's, I have a version of it. She has made an English translation of it, chantable in the original tune, you know. It's really nice. But she kept all the special, you know, all the mantras, etc., all in Tibetan and Sanskrit. So, like that. So, I don't know, did I answer your question? The answer is it depends. It depends. If you do a practice long enough, you will, even though you are saying it in Tibetan, you know what the meaning is. You know. So, for example, I go for refuge until enlightenment. That chant in Tibetan. You know, I do it sometimes in Tibetan now, but I know what it means. To me. It means, you know, I don't have to think about it, right? So that's one benefit. You know, you do certain things, after a while you get the sense of it, and that's really what's important, right? And the rest of the time you do it in whatever is most familiar to you, what feels most natural to you. So none of this is cast in stone, you know, it's just... And some teachers are more strict than others. You know, some will insist you do them in Tibetan. I come from California, Vajrapani, where which was started by Lama Yeshe, who was an iconoclast. You know, he was like, you know, so all his students who still are there, they're much more into just, like Venerable Rene, for example, they're much more into like translate it to English, put tunes to it, make it more modern, you know. Others, you know, they want to stick with the Tibetan. You know, so so there's that kind of thing too. Okay. So that's the accumulation of merit. So we did we've absorbed the Buddha. So we feel close to the Buddha. We feel like, we can gain their realizations. We've made our prayers for their blessings and so forth and so on. And so now we can do So here, what I would suggest is do maybe 5 minutes, you know, in the beginning at least. 5 minutes of just concentration meditation, right? Just to have a flavor, just to keep it going, right? Because it's important to have, to continue to develop Kamabiding, by the way, is just a fancy word for developing highest level of concentration, right? So that when we do analytical meditations like on the Lam Rim, we can have supreme focus, single-pointed concentration, they say, without being distracted, without worrying about what's going to happen today and tomorrow and, you know, I'm hungry or I'm thirsty or my stomach's growling and all that stuff, right? So you have this single point of concentration on the topic, on whatever your precious human rebirth, death and impermanence, bodhicitta, whatever quality you're trying to develop, you have concentration on that. And if you have single point of concentration, it goes so fast. You progress so rapidly. It's just incredible. Yeah. So maybe we won't generate calm abiding in this lifetime. But if we do it 5 minutes, 10 minutes, we again keep the imprint in our minds. You know, that's the most important thing. You know, we have to remember, as my teacher told me once when I was somewhat depressed and felt that I wasn't making much progress. He said that, you know, you have to remember that, you know, he held out his ala, you know, and he said that, you know, your life is just this one bead. There's many, many other lives. You just have to keep the long view. So you keep, if you can't succeed, you may not become a Buddha in this lifetime. You may not even achieve bodhicitta in this lifetime. If you're lucky, you get precious human rebirth in this lifetime. But that's okay. You create the imprint so that we can continue in our next life. We meet our gurus, we meet our teachers, we meet the Dharma, we create the causes to to be born a human being again, so that, you know, we can continue, right? So that's the most important thing. So that's why they say, just do any what little bit you can, right? And that's the whole point of this practice. Any little bit that we can to do this practice creates the imprints, you know. So we can do 5 minutes, 10 minutes, whatever you can, whatever, you know, in your day of calm abiding meditation. And then we'll talk more about this. Maybe I'll ask the Geshe nun who's coming next week to teach, and I can't remember her name. Maybe I will ask her to talk about how to meditate on the Lam Rim. You know, she would be wonderful, wonderfully qualified, much better than me. But what I'll say is, so will you do the 5 minutes of that, and then the contemplation of the graduated path, this is basically a, what's called a review meditation. You just kind of go through the points of the Lam Rim. This is the entire Lam Rim in one page or whatever, two pages. Okay? So this basically gives us an overview of the Lam Rim. Right? And then, at the end of it, we do whatever Lam Rim topic we are meditating on. Right? So let's say it's Precious Human Rebirth, or maybe the next class. I don't know. What is the next class? Samsara. There we go. Oh, that's a good one. So lots to meditate on there. So you can, when you're doing that class, you do this practice, and at the end of this analytical meditation, I mean, end of this review, you basically say, okay, I'll do 5 minutes, 10 minutes of samsara, you know. So like that. And then you finish by dedicating. Right? So that's how this can become, if you make it so, this can become just basic your framework to do whatever you're doing kind of fits into this. So that's why I've been doing this for 10, 12 years. I just do, you know, and I get different advice. You know, every couple of years my teacher will say, okay, why don't you do this now? So I'll just then find a place here to kind of fit it in, right? Because we can't not accumulate merit. We have to accumulate merit. So we have to do something like this. So that's kind of how it works, right? Also, don't feel pressured that you have to do this whole thing in one go, okay? So maybe you don't have that much. First of all, I would suggest that you do this first thing in the morning, right? You get your cup of coffee. You, maybe you've brushed your sheet, maybe you haven't, whatever, you wash your face, and you do this, you know, because you want to do this before your mind gets all consumed by, I don't know, the emails and the all the other stuff that happens there, right? So let's say that you were able to do the, you know, you got through the, you know, the seven limb prayer, and you ran out of time. You know, you've got 20 minutes in the morning. You ran out of time. You did that, and now you have to go to work and so forth and so on. You that's fine. You know, I would suggest maybe if you are able to do the calm abiding meditation with it, because your mind is already at a very clear state after doing the mantra. Mantras usually do that. That's why, you know, especially with the blessings and stuff, it's really nice to do the calm abiding meditation. So if you can stop there, and then maybe later on in the afternoon, evening, whenever you come home, if you have time, you do the review meditation. And, you know, maybe you start with a little bit of calm abiding to settle the mind after the day, right? You do the review meditation, and you do the Lam Rim topic, and you do the dedication, right? Like that. That, you know, because, for example, Lama Zopa, I'm not, you know, what I'm telling you, I'm not just making this up, right? Because Lama Zopa, for example, you know, he will do, if he's leading a retreat, he'll in the morning, you know, he'll start his Guru Yoga practice, or, you know, the Guru Yoga practice, which is Lama Chopa Guru Yoga, which takes hour and a half, 2 hours, something like that. I don't know. So, you know, we do it for an hour and it's time for breakfast. Well, you got to stop. You know, one of the students will say, Rinpoche, I think it's time to stop now. I said, okay, we'll stop. So then, you know, so you imagine that, you know, so you absorb the Buddha, you kind of imagine, okay, I'm the Buddha now. I'm going to hang out as kind of like the Buddha, right? And then I'm just going to go do on my day. Then I'll come back and I'll just continue on, right? It doesn't mean that all of it has to be done in one go, and if you break it up, it's going to mess things up. None of that stuff, right? So, again, you can fit it in your work schedule the best way you can. meditations in general, they say it's better to do short sessions, right, than long sessions. So in other words, let's say that you are really good at concentration meditation, right? You can easily handle, I don't know, whatever, right? But the better thing to do is, especially when you're starting out, is to do 5 minute, maybe 5 minute sessions. So for some people, maybe it's 3 minute sessions, depending on how long you can keep your mind and one on the object, you know, on the, you know, like breathing or whatever meditation you're doing, right? Like the breathing meditation. If you're able to stay on the breath for 3 minutes, great, right? Or 5 minutes, great. But don't push it, right? If you want to do more, you do 5 minutes and you take a break. Take a break for 2 minutes, let's say. You can have a clock, right? You take a break for 2 minutes or 5 minutes, whatever. But during that break, you don't let your mind wander, you know, about what YouTube video you saw yesterday and so forth and so on, right? You kind of just stay kind of you ease up. You kind of just rest. And then you do another 5 minutes or 3 minutes or whatever it is, right? So it's better to do, it's quality is better than quantity, right? So it's better to do short sessions than one long session, let's say 10, 20 minutes. And what happens is you're struggling in between. And by the 15th minute, you're basically like, now you're just kind of annoyed that you're not able to do it. So, you know, it's counterproductive. What you want to do is, our minds want to do things that seem we are good at, right? So if we can do 5 minute meditation, our mind is we're going to want to come back and do a meditation again. If we do a 20 minute meditation and we end the meditation in frustration, we don't want to going to want to do it again next day, right? So that's why it's best to, and then as over time you increase it, right? I mean, you kind of, you know, then you know how to pace yourself. So then you make it 10 minutes and you break for 5 or whatever it is, right? And so like that, that's the best way to do these meditations. And the same is true for analytical meditations, you know. And we talked about when you're doing analytical meditation, how to do it, right? In the Lamri meditation where you think about the topic and you generate that aha, you know, like ah. You know, this is true. And you stay on it, right? Then you do concentration on that, right? Like, you can do concentration on the breath. You do concentration on precious human rebirth. You know, you go through the points. And you say, wow, that's true. And then you sit. And you just use that as the object. And after a while, it'll dissipate, right? And then you think about the points again. And then you get, oh, aha. And then you again stay on that feeling, right? And on and on and on. And that's what actually builds the realization. When they say you have a realization, it becomes kind of like a direct perception. You know, you don't have to. So later on, if you've done this for weeks and whatever it is, however long it takes you, if somebody says, precious, you know, you wake up in the morning, you think, precious human rebirth, that feeling is right there. You don't have to, like, think about the points. Oh, yeah, you know, the eight, you know, freedoms and the 10 fortunes, blah, 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 all that stuff, right? That you know, that's when you know you have a realization, right? That feeling is there, that, oh, wow, I have this incredible life. I cannot waste it, right? And so that's when we have the realization. Right. So that's how to use this practice. So I encourage you to do it, you know. If you've forgotten I'm sure you won't remember the tune. I think they're recording it. You can get it from there. If not, this tune is also on the website at vajrapani.org. If you send me an email, if you're interested, I can send you the link. Yeah. Okay. So why don't we do the review, you know, the review, Lam Rim review here, and then we'll end with the dedication for tonight. Unless there are any questions. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. That was a couple of years ago. Okay. Yes. Yes. So if you're doing the Lama Tsongkhapa Guru Yoga, you can continue doing that practice. If you find, I'm sorry, what was your question? I interrupted you. Yes. Oh, it's just as valid. It's just as valid. You're not going to miss out anything if you're doing that practice instead of this one. To some extent, for Lam Rim, for Lam Rim realization, that practice, Lama Tsongkhapa, is probably, you know, more profound. You know, so you're not missing out anything. You know, this practice is slightly easier, I think, because it requires less explanation than a Lama Tsongkhapa Guru Yoga. That's the main reason that I was, and I try to do different things different times. You know, so that's the other reason. And this one's chantable. That's the other reason I thought, you know, and it's kind of, I like the wording, you know, I like the King of Prayers. The prayer is really nice, you know. Right, sure. So if you like, you know, one day if you're on a weekend and you have more time and you like these words, you can replace where it says in the Lama Tsongkhapa Guru Yoga, you can replace the seven-limb prayer there with the seven-limb prayer here. Nothing's stopping you from doing that, you know? So. Okay. So let's do the contemplation of the graduated path. Whatever you want for yourself and others, with a human form is easily attained. Disengage yourself from meaningless efforts. Strive to accomplish the highest goals. Because all things composite are impermanent, life changes and never abides. That change is the basis of suffering, for the samsaric mind fills with frustration on watching its creations continually fade. So this is the impermanence, the impermanent. We did the precious human rebirth, now we're doing impermanence. The higher you climb in samsara, the higher the cliff on which you perch, the more things you own, the tighter you are bound. The dearer you hold someone, the greater the chance he will hurt you. The faster you subdue enemies, the faster their numbers increase. This body is a thing borrowed for a moment, and possessions are things stored for others. Now we dally with them, but quickly are they lost and misused, and only are sources of misery. Therefore, no worldly possession is worth the effort of gaining. Turn your back on that which only handicaps. An unburdened mind is joy supreme. The pinnacle of aims is to follow this path, body, speech, and mind kept stainless with pure self-discipline, mind held in samadhi, blissful and clear, and wisdom seeing all realities of every situation. The mother beings, samadhi, by the way, is, it's like a state of meditation, you know, various planes of meditation. So samadhi is like, you know, in a state of meditation, mind held in samadhi, equanimity in this case almost. The mother beings wandering in the six realms, to me their child, are pieces of my heart. For many times have they soothed my troubles, and infinite ways have they brought me joy. So this is the one on bodhicitta and compassion. These infinite beings, so kind, are covered by the fog of ignorance, constantly lashed by whips of delusions. They have no chance to lay down the burden of misery from their minds. Therefore, whenever you meet anyone, greet them with eyes smiling with love. Why mention that you should not even consider holding evil intentions or deceptive thoughts? The way people and things seem to be other than projected labels is a distortion created by deluded mind. If we look at the root of things, emptiness is clearly understood. And in the vast space of perception of emptiness, mental grasping for ultimate subsides. Then one looks into the face of the world, and everything is seen without essence. Understanding interdependence, we understand emptiness. Understanding emptiness, we understand interdependence. This is the view which is the middle, and which is beyond the terrifying cliffs of eternalism, nihilism, neither or both. So the emptiness part, if it doesn't make sense, just don't worry about it. It will at some point. It is quite profound, so, yeah. And then we end with a dedication. This one actually does have a tune. By the merit of this virtue, may I become Buddha and lead all beings, everyone, into that enlightened state. May the precious Bodhi mind not yet born arise and grow, and may that born not decline, but increase more and more. And then there's an appendix of Lama Tsongkhapa, why he said we should make prayers before meditation. So that's, I guess Venerable Rene wanted to put it in there. So that's the practice. And I hope you do it. I hope it works. It will work. We have to give it time. And so that's it for tonight. We did our dedication. Yes. Oh, and I guess I'm always supposed to say something about generosity. So everything, as you know, is given free of charge here. But anything that you can help us with is greatly appreciated. So, yeah. Thank you very much. See you next week, I guess. Yeah.
Thank you.
Bye now.